Welcome everyone to Radio Free Nintendo. We're back. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me, as always, James Jones.
As always.
John Lindemann.
Making a cameo appearance. I look forward to being gone for the next 3 weeks, then I'll come back, maybe.
And unfortunately, Guillaume can't be with us this week. He's still on some vacation kick or something or other. He will be back next time for 300, of course. And I thought we were going to have to do a three-man show, but at the very last minute, a wild Greg Leahy appeared.
Somebody put up the Yoshi signal. Just in time.
Stepping out of the phone booth.
Greg is saving our ass this weekend.
Save us from ourselves.
He is not only appearing on the show, which I know will make a lot of people happy, but he is also offered to edit this episode, which makes me incredibly happy because I thought I was going to have to do part of it myself again. And 298, now this was a couple weeks ago, but the listener mail alone for 298, it was an hour and 15 minute segment, took me well over 6 hours to edit. So now finally, in the sixth year of our Lord, Evan Birchfield, I finally appreciate just how much difficult.
And that's the end of this episode.
You better watch that one.
I really, really do appreciate just how much time goes into this shit.
As Johnny complains about editing the that one segment for 6 hours, it took me an hour to edit the now playing segment.
I believe it.
You write the script. That is all entirely your fault.
Well, to be fair, the script I wrote for that week was asinine.
Yes. It was beautifully asinine. So, Greg, as you return to help us out in a moment of need, I retroactively thank you so much for editing all those episodes. And Guillaume as well, who's been doing a smash-up job the past few months.
See, I knew you were faking it 2 months ago. This time it's genuine.
I understood. Let's make it clear. I understood what that meant.
So we've had some interesting things going up on the feed the past few weeks. So we had 298, which was edited by James and myself. Well, Guillaume did new business, to be fair. So yeah. He did a lot of work on it still. Hopefully no one really noticed. I mean, it was in the show notes, but hopefully it sounded pretty consistent and pretty standard quality, except to Greg, who I'm sure hears all the little nooks and crannies that everybody else misses.
No, it's all right. The train takes care of that.
Yeah. He's no longer cranking it up to 11 in his headphones at home, staring at his computer. But I did actually want to extend, we have a lot of thanks to give out. I wanted to thank Scott and Zach for hosting and editing a very, very fun episode of NWR Jeopardy last week with James and Guillaume and also Don Koopman from the Famicast. I thought it was really fun to listen to, and it helped fill in a gap that we thought we were going to have in our schedule. But also, we had actually two substitutes for the price of one last week because some amazing guys from the forums, the NWR forums, and well-known listeners of this podcast, guys who have emailed us many times and have talked to us on various Twitters and Facebooks and et cetera, got together to do their own podcast, which hopefully you've already heard right now. They called it Nintendo Free Radio, and they went for 3 hours talking about literally dozens of video games, and I thought did an amazing job, considering it was their first time doing that. As far as I know, first time for any of them doing that kind of thing. I thought they sounded fantastic. They had a really good rapport. The editing was really tight. There was no crosstalk, which is hard to do and is a lot of work to pull that off. And just was a really interesting, fun to listen to conversation. Funny, lots of inside jokes. I just couldn't have been more impressed with it. And I said, I'm putting this up on our feed because I want everybody else to hear this. And if you like it, I hope you will go visit the forums. It's in the feed. That is the link. That's what it goes to. That's the article page. It's in right there in the forums. And I hope you'll leave a comment for those guys and let them know. I believe they might be getting together again. That seemed to be implied in the forum thread that they might be doing more episodes of that. And if they do so, I will encourage them to create their own podcast feed, and we will try to get you a link for it so that you can follow what they do in the future. because I thought it was really good stuff. So thanks a lot to those guys. That was Sarek, Racked, Brood Wars, and Shaman. I was blown away by it, so thank you guys so much. Also wanted to note that prep for RFN 300 is well underway. The emails have been fast and furious. I've got big ideas. There's a big, big show outline in honor of Greg that I put together for RFN 300. And we're planning to have some special guests and just do a lot of fun stuff. So look forward to that next week. For this episode, we're going to keep it pretty standard other than our surprise guest. We're going to do a new business and listener mail. And Greg, I was hoping you would do the honors of catching us up on your recent exploits in the world of video games.
Sure, yeah. Been plenty of stuff over the past several weeks, so mostly portable still. I've had more time to do console gaming, but haven't actually done that much of it. Although I did play through Dead Space 2, which I've been meaning to do for a while.
Oh, that's good.
Radiant Silver Gun a bit as well, but not too much. What I'm going to start with is something I think is beautifully timely, because just today in North America, Warrior Land finally came out for the 3DS eShop. So what have I been playing but Warrior Land 2 that came out last week in Europe? And it's a game that I've always heard great things about, been kind of looking forward to playing it for a while.
I can't believe you've never played it before.
No. Well, remember, I didn't get a handheld till the GBA, so it was before my time. And it's one of those things I always kind of wanted to get back to, and I did get Warrior Land 3, mm-hmm. so that kind of satisfied my desire for more Warrior Lands at that time, and then I hadn't played the second one before. But I mean, the landmark with Warrior Land 2 is the first of the Warrior Land games that got rid of your ability to die. So you're invulnerable, essentially. Although, if you get hit, you lose coins. And like a certain upcoming game, it is all about the coins.
Yeah.
So to kind of go through the way the game works, like the first time you play through the game, there is no kind of overworld map like the original Warrior Land or like Super Mario Land 2. You just sort of proceed from chapter to chapter in completely sort of linear fashion.
Well, you think it's linear.
and then got through the end of the game, kind of enjoyed playing it. And then after that is when everything really opens up.
Yeah.
And in fact, you find that there's like twice the game.
At least, yes.
It's really quite impressive. I've just started to sort of scratch the surface of all the extra stuff that's in it. Basically, what you get is this sort of branching tree of levels, and you could see like where there's a little fork off, like an alternate exit or something that leads to a whole other set of levels with a unique boss at the end or stuff like that. And certainly the first lot of those that I've played was a significant increase in sort of complexity, I felt like, than the ones that I just played through to sort of get through to the quote unquote end of the game. And so that's helped for me, because I think playing through the first set of levels, it was definitely fun, and you can mess around with the transformations. You have certain enemies, when they hurt you, you will actually change into, like, you know, you get flattened into a sort of paper thin Wario, or you get fed cake and turn into fat Wario. A lot of these came back in 3 and even 4, which you were not invulnerable in, but you'll be talking about that in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
But those transformations are that kind of puzzle element was in there from the start, but I didn't feel like it was all that strongly emphasized until I started playing some of these extra levels. And it's important to know, like, why you want to be collecting a lot of coins and preserving them by not getting hurt, because you spend the coins essentially on these like mini games to get a treasure and a bit of the map. And I think if you get all of those at the end of the game, there's some special ending or a secret level or something. So I've been trying to kind of stay ahead of the curve, because with some of them, like, there's one that's at the end of every level where, like, you just get bits of a number, a digit, getting revealed gradually. And you have to kind of, as soon as you've got enough information to answer it, you answer it. But all the time, your money is going down as more is revealed. So sometimes, you know, if it's something like you're trying to distinguish whether it's a, you know, a 0 or an 8, you know, you're waiting for that one particular part of the picture to disappear before you can actually confirm it. That can cost you a lot of money. So you kind of want to stockpile as much money as possible so that you can get through those situations without like maybe having to like grind for money at any particular point. So there's some motivation there to play cautiously, but it's not necessarily all that strong. So it's got kind of a casual kind of feel to it. So it is mostly about exploring if you feel like it, and a little bit of light puzzle solving that's starting to get stronger. And in that way, it's almost got a bit of a sensibility about it that's kind of like 3D platformers of the time, in the sense that it's not about like twitch reflexes or anything like that, which I think is a good fit for this is the Game Boy Color version that they've put on the eShop. And
oh, I was going to ask, so this is the color version, because the game was originally released on black and white Game Boy, and then when Game Boy Color came out, they released a new version that was backwards compatible with black and white, but also featured full color graphics if you played it on GBC. And that's the one I had.
So, yeah, it's the GBC version, and it's not the full whack GBC price. Like $6 was Link's Awakening, right? This is $5. So it certainly seems like a very good value proposition given how much content is in the game. But like I said, I think it's a good fit for this particular kind of hardware, because on the one hand, like if you're going to do like a kind of twitch, fast paced kind of platformer on the Game Boy, there are certain kind of limitations with that. Obviously, like if you think of Super Mario Land, like just how small everything is and completely without detail and stuff, but it kind of makes it work on that kind of resolution. Whereas for something like Wario Land, but you've got these big, quite detailed, really nicely animated given the technologies. But Wario has a lot of personality, his belly sort of flowing all over the place, and the way his awkward way that he runs and the transformations, like it's really quite vibrant for the time. But of course, what that means is that he takes up a lot of the screen, there's not a lot of space. I don't think it would really work if it were fast paced or all about your reflexes and all that. So I think it took the design in the original Wario Land, which when I played that, I said it was, you could feel that it was like this of interstitial sort of game between the Mario template and the more evolved Wario one. And here you see the full sort of flower of that concept. So it makes perfect sense that it's slower and more puzzle and stuff, but sometimes I do feel like it's a bit too slow. Like I would like it to, I do prefer like maybe a bit more action kind of in the platforming, especially because you can't die and all that. Sometimes it can feel like a bit of a slog, just like investigating a lot of walls. It does get quite Metroid-y, like just let me just bash this wall and see if it leads to a room full of coins, or maybe where the treasure for that particular level is kept in a secret room or something, so you're doing a lot of that. And so I found it's kind of better to play it maybe in smaller doses, which of course it's always been well suited to, but never more so than on the virtual console with all the kind of options you've got for interrupting it.
And Greg, when you say it's Metroid-y, I mean, I think what you mean is the original Metroid, when you were kind of laying bombs all over the place because the graphics weren't detailed enough to give you clues as to where you might be able to make a tunnel.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that bad, obviously. There are like a certain amount of visual clues that you'll get. In certain cases, there is a bit of that. Even in Metroid, you do get it, but especially in the later ones, the so-called Metroid sense, you can kind of intuit that something, even if it doesn't necessarily look suspicious in itself, if you put it in a wider context, you can kind of intuit that there might be something there. But it could be a bit fiddly sometimes. For instance, take when you're fighting the bosses, which I like. They're full of personality, some kind of fun designs in there. But what will happen, of course, is that you can't die. So what's the problem? Well, but if you get hit once, it'll always like send you out of the boss room, and then you'll have to make your way back to the boss room to fight it again.
It's annoyance as deterrent.
Yes.
It's very different from like Kirby's Epic Yarn is another game where you have boss battles and your character can't die. And the way they do it there is they just punish you by basically taking away your coins or your points or whatever those things are called in
that game. Which is funny, because in Wario Land that applies for all of the level until the boss, in which case it will not take away your coins. It will just kick you out of that room and provide that sort of irritant, like you said. It's surprising, actually, how much it feels like, well, you're almost splitting hairs. This kind of feels quite a lot like dying.
Yes. Like, you just have infinite lives.
Yeah, it is almost like that. But I mean, in certain cases with the bosses, it almost seems a little bit harsh, because like I said, you just get hit once and it's over, essentially. But I mean, most of them aren't too hard or anything like that. But I think what I've found sometimes is just like it can be a bit sort of crunchy playing through a Wario Land level where, you know, it's not the smoothest experience in the world. You're kind of doing all this stuff, but it's definitely a much more thoughtful platformer than you're probably accustomed to playing at the time. And I've really enjoyed it so far, and it seems like it's going to get way more interesting as I find some of these secrets. I mean, I love the way you find the first secret. I don't think I ever would have found this out for myself. I saw on the map that there's another path coming from the very first level.
Yeah.
So I just kind of played through that level again and could not discern how there could be another path to it at all. And I suppose, you know, you could consider this a spoiler, but the way you discover the secret level is that Wario starts the level asleep. And if you basically refuse to wake up, it will end the level in a different way.
Yep.
With the enemies that come along and take him out of his bed. And then it's like starts like a sort of alternate history of the game.
It's not, well, it doesn't just unlock one level. It unlocks a whole branch of the level map.
Exactly.
So it actually doing that unlocks several levels. Which it sounds like it, boy, that's really harsh to lock away so much content of the game behind this really obscure thing. But again, the map actually gives you a clue that something's going on there. So the idea is that eventually you'll just get desperate and try something really strange and out of the box. And that ends up being what does it.
Yeah, the fact that you've got like those paths coming off on this branching map, you will know which levels to kind of get experimental in.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, people talk about the similarities between, you know, the new Super Mario Bros. 2 concept and a Wario game. But, you know, I think there is a big difference in that hopefully what I'm hoping for from new Super Mario Bros. 2 is there's going to be a lot more of a skill element to racking up huge coin accumulation. You know, the some of the things you see in trailers, like, well, okay, if I take the gold Koopa shell and bounce it off this wall so it kills 5 enemies in a row and then follow the coin trail and you get this huge number of coins, you know, that kind of thing to me is something that's skill-based and makes it more like a real high score kind of thing rather than just, well, I've been everywhere, I've seen everything and I've accumulated all the coins that come with that, which is more what you've got in something like Wario Land. I mean, there's still a skill component in terms of getting to some of these more out-of-the-way places and avoiding taking hits that will cause you to lose a few coins, but it's really just about having the patience and being inquisitive.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, with the coin rush and all that, you know, I think New Super Mario Bros. 2 could be a completely different kind of experience, as superficially similar as the concept may seem. That's what I'm hoping for, anyway. I mean, it was funny when TYP was on a bit ago, and he said, like, oh, well, I don't play Mario as a score attack. And I thoroughly agreed with that, but that's kind of the point, isn't it? This might actually make you do it. It might actually be different enough that you do the coin rush mode.
It might, but wouldn't you like to have some kind of online leaderboard so you can compare your scores to your friends?
That is very concerning for me. That this, if they're going to just rely on Street Pass, which yeah. It seems like it might be the case, that would be a bit of a disappointment. But I've got on with score games in the past that don't have them, but it's a big difference, and that actually kind of leads in to what I was going to talk about next, because I've been playing a lot of pinball, and this story goes weird places, so you'll have to bear with me. But yeah, so I've been playing plenty of video pinball. I've been playing some Pinball Arcade on the 360, actually, which is all the real tables.
Mm-hmm. Is that good?
It's significantly better than when it was the Williams collection and stuff. Like, the physics is even better than before. The lighting and the visuals look better than before. And obviously, like, compared with the Wii version that I had, you have got online leaderboards now. If you play on 360 or PS3, or it's going to be on a bunch of stuff, isn't it? It was meant to be on 3DS, like, but I think they're having trouble porting it down. And I'm sure it will be on Wii U. But yeah, I mean, if you like playing, you know, the actual tape, I think especially if you have some appreciation for, like, real pinball machines from the old days, you know, like 20 years ago or more, then I think you could get something out of it. And they're, like, doing Kickstarter things for famous tables, like Twilight Zone's coming, and I think Star Trek Next Generation's a possibility. And so, I mean, the DLC possibilities down the line are quite exciting. But that was one pinball game. And then I got Marvel Pinball, which I got off to a really rocky start on, like, because there's this game-killing glitch in the Fantastic Four table. And it happened to me once. Like, what happens is you can build up, like, the negative zone ball save or whatever, where Mr. Fantastic, like, reaches into a hole and saves your ball from oblivion. But the bug results in him reaching into the hole and pulling nothing out. And then you are fucked.
That's like being the worst magician ever. Look at it, pulling the rabbit out of my... Oh, God, it's gone.
It's gone and it's never coming back.
So how easy was it for you to hit that bug, Greg?
It was like my third go at the table.
Stuff like that amazes me. Like,
it did amaze me. And I read about it a bit online. It seemed like it was a fairly common sort of glitch. But, you know, it didn't like happen all the time or anything. But plenty of people had experienced it. But it was the first, like I said, it was like my third go or something. So I was setting a new score, but it was never going to be one that was going to stand for very long. So I wasn't that bothered. And then I went back and forth to the four different tables you get with it for a while. And I was doing Fantastic Four again. And this time I was smashing my previous score and setting a really high one. And it happened again. And that fucking put me off that game for a while. I was irrationally angry. It's like you could play one of the other tables that probably doesn't have a game breaking. No, don't want it.
Well, it sounds like you're spoiled for choice on pinball, so...
Yeah, I've got other options, but
That's pretty terrible, though.
Yeah, it's bad, and I've since set some pretty high Fantastic Four scores that would be higher than those ones that got ruined, whatever have been, and it's been fine. But I hope there is going to be, like, an official patch, a fix or something, because that could be, you know, especially as Guillaume said, talking about pinball before, you know, as you get better, if you're going to beat your score, it's going to take longer and longer. Yeah. And you just feel like it's more time for it to go wrong. So it's going to be pretty nerve-wracking. It's like, on the one hand, it's like, oh, great, I've got the ball safe. But wait, it could ruin the game completely. So there's a nasty little switcheroo, but... The online leaderboards in that are good, but obviously you've got the friend stuff, and Guillaume's got some nice surprises waiting for him when he gets back from his cabin.
Oh, gauntlet thrown.
Of course, Johnny can't see any of this because his 3DS is gone, unfortunately. I'm very sad to hear about that.
Yeah, thanks.
I was really hoping a happy ending would happen, like the last time you lost a Nintendo handheld, like, was it in your ski boot or something?
Yes, I found it a long time later.
That's a good place to store it, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen this time. I'll talk about it a little bit later.
I know. But my condolences. But anyway, so the online leaderboards have been good. You're sort of aiming to beat people's scores and stuff. It's definitely, when I got it, it was a bit after everyone else, and especially with the little layoff I had some pretty daunting stuff to shoot at, but I've attained respectability now. But my favourite thing was looking at the big leaderboards, like everyone's ones, and seeing some familiar names. Like, one of them was Falcon Payne, which is a very ominous sounding name. Makes me think of someone like just playing Smash Brothers with only Captain Falcon doing the Falcon Punch over and over and over again. I mean, inexplicably good at it. But I was like, I know that name from somewhere. And I realized, like, back when Metroid Prime Pinball, like, you could register the game with Club Nintendo in America and then put your score on a website. That guy was like at the top. Like, he had like 5 of the top 10 or something ridiculous.
That's hilarious.
So were you playing the American version of Metroid Prime Pinball?
I did, yeah. Wow. This was in the halcyon days of $2 to the pound. It was cheaper to import.
Oh, wow. Hey, that's a hell of a good game, really.
Oh, I love that guy.
That's a great game. I love that game so much.
But then, and another one I really enjoyed, there was somebody who had a dauntingly high score at one of the tables called Vote Romney. Which nice. I thought was funny, because I was thinking, like, is this just like someone who really passionately believes in Mitt Romney that wanted to put it out there? Or is it in fact like one of his social media team in a really desperate attempt to put his name out there?
Really desperate. Oh, man.
Training, getting really good at Marvel Pinball. In a cubicle somewhere, because they can't afford any more ad time or something.
That is viral campaign right there.
That is grassroots. That's beyond grassroots.
Yeah, it's grass smoking.
Yeah.
But on the complete opposite end of the pinball spectrum, right, and this is where the story gets weird, I bought on eBay a copy of the secret sequel to Devil's Crush for the Super Nintendo called Yaki Crush, which basically substitutes,
wow,
like, you know, the sort of heavy metal cover artwork of Devil's Crush. But instead of that, it's like Japanese mythology demons.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's roughly commensurate with one another.
Yeah, so it's like, I like Devil's Crush. I mean, the physics compared to stuff like Pinball Arcade are a joke. And because it scrolls, it kind of has to play a bit slowly, because otherwise it would be like you wouldn't even see where the ball was going. Mm-hmm. So obviously it's not like realistic or anything, but that's kind of what's fun about it as a compliment, is that it's completely different. You have all these like crazy characters and Mode 7 stuff going on in the Super Nintendo version.
But Devil's Crush, isn't there something about it, like, doesn't it have this kind of adventure game aspect to it? Or it's not purely arcade pinball, is it?
Well, it's kind of not necessarily that different from something like Marvel Pinball, in that you've kind of got like missions, you know? So if you do like all the different missions, and maybe some other requirements, like, you can actually get to a credit screen. There is an ending to the game.
Okay.
That applies in both Devil's Crush and this Yakky Crush for the Super Nintendo. And I haven't seen the end, so, because I am awful at the missions. I'm really bad. I finally get there and I just screw it up straight away. It really seemed quite hard for me anyway. But the biggest difference with the missions actually would be that you can't, unlike something like Marvel Pinball, you like warp to a different screen completely.
Yeah, so that sounds more like a Mario Pinball, or, oh, don't get me started on Pinball Quest. We need to find out who owns the rights to Pinball Quest, and so we can get a Kickstarter to purchase those and just release it as freeware online, because that game is amazing.
I'm interested.
Yeah, so am I. I've never played it.
Well, if you're into the whole emulation scene, I would recommend it, because I haven't heard a peep about this game in forever. I don't know who owns it, but they're not doing anything with it. But it's an amazing NES pinball game that has, I think, four different modes, and a couple of them, one of them is kind of a mini game, I think. A couple of them are like really good standard pinball boards, and the fourth one is a quest mode where you proceed from screen to screen. It's actually kind of like WizOrb, if anybody's played that indie game that's on PSN and Steam, I think. It's so good. I mean, there was nothing like it. This was, you know, 20, 25 years ago. I thought it was just incredible. It was like a really early take on, hey, pinball is this thing that's obviously sort of past its prime in the arcade room. Can we bring it to the home console and do something completely different with it that would just be impossible in a real pinball table? And they did something so different with it. It was amazing. I mean, you go into shops and buy items and things like that. It's right. Really, really clever.
And to get back to where it was, where this goes from is that the guy that I bought the Yakky Crush from on eBay, when I was checking his feedback, he had sold a copy of Demon's Crest for a disgustingly reasonable price prior to that. I missed out on this. But I thought, well, I'll save him as a seller in case he gets anything else cool, or he's got something else cool that he'll one day sell. And then at some point it came up that he was selling one of those PSPs that we've made fun of that took out the Wi-Fi. And you're like, it's just like a mono speaker and all that. Like, it's the super budget model that's just for Europe. He was selling one of those with the UMD drive broken. And I just kind of giggled to myself, like, oh, that's hilarious. He's selling a paperweight. Like, but then I thought about it a bit more. I thought, hang on a minute. No one is going to want to buy this, but I could actually make use of it. You know, I could get some of those stupid memory sticks. And I've already got a bunch of PS1 classics that I could transfer over from the PS3 and use it to play that way. And there's a select group of games on the PSP that I do actually want to play. I would never be willing to pay. I mean, this thing retails for like 90 quid. It's still way too expensive to even consider paying for.
Especially
it.
Especially when it's dead. It's a dead platform.
Yeah, it seems like it's... But the thing is, apparently it was like pretty much brand new, but the UMD drive just didn't work, and apparently it couldn't be bothered to fix it or, you know, anything like that. So I got it for less than $20.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Effectively fully functional. Like, I mean, you can say the UMD drive's broken, it doesn't have Wi-Fi, but you can download things on your computer.
But you can't watch UMD movies.
Well, Spider-Man 2, I've been wanting that on UMD for so long.
Oh, let me tell you, buddy, it's awesome.
Kill Bill Volume 2 on UMD is the best version.
No, I mean, for me, it was like, well, this is pretty much what I do. I don't want a bunch of UMDs lying around, and the prices tend to have got more reasonable and stuff, and they have sales, like they had that Vita sale that also discounted PSP games, so I got Tactics Ogre for 8 quid.
Wow.
I mean, that was a pretty nice bit of business there. But the main thing that I had my eye on to purchase this bizarre PSP 4 was a little game called Goku Makaimura Kai, otherwise known as Ultimate Ghosts and Goblins Revised.
I was just looking for that online yesterday, by the way. It's still $20 everywhere.
This is Ultimate Ghosts and Goblins for the PSP, but basically it did away with all the extra adventure kind of elements to it and sort of redid it as a straight Ghosts and Goblins game. So you don't have a life meter anymore. You don't have inventory anymore. Like before, the double jump was an ability that you found, whereas now it's just you have it from the start. So it's taking the level designs that they had before and just turning it into a true arcade-style Ghosts and Goblins, Ghouls and Ghosts game. And it's, I love it. It's awesome.
Yeah, I want it bad.
It's, I mean, the graphics are almost literally too flashy. It has this weird fetish for lighting effects. But they are really nice. And I kept looking at them thinking this would look great on 3DS because it's got polygonal geometry and some of the environments are actually quite grand. But you don't have the depth there. It's the first time I've ever looked at something and thought it's missing the 3D. Like, I'm guessing like Castlevania Lords of Shadow, Mirror of Fate will make similarly nice use of the 3D as something like this could.
It does indeed, yes.
So, you know, I would love it if they just thought, fuck it, we'll just re-release this for other people, because the revised version that was not as contentious, because I guess the thing is, you've got to understand, is that Ultimate Ghosts and Goblins, when it originally came off, managed to piss off a lot of different people at once.
Yeah, it was kind of an impressive act, actually.
It did get some good reviews, but the problem was, on the one hand, it was still too Ghosts and Goblins-y for some people because it still has basically the same jumping mechanics and all that kind of stuff. Although it does feature both the double jump and the ability to shoot up and down, which makes the game quite a lot more playable than either Ghouls and Ghosts or Super Ghouls and Ghosts.
Yeah, and that would really piss the purists off, I'm sure.
Well, what pissed the purists off is all the RPG-ish stuff, like the inventory and the life bar, and the fact that to see the true ending of the game, you've got to find like every special chest. Mm-hmm. You've basically got to go poke around all these different places, and you go on a banana hunt, or something, you know, like that, which is not very Ghosts and Goblins-y at all. And so like, it managed to kind of piss off both camps. And at least with this version, it's kind of like, well, you know, if you love the old games, this is for you. And the result is the levels do have a lot of extra stuff that you don't really need to deal with, which is nice in a way, because it feels like, well, it might be something worth discovering, there might not be, but let's give it a go. It's a bit like bits of Dracula X that have that kind of level design as well, it ends up being. But it, despite some weirdness where you can kind of see they've retrofitted this a bit, it does totally work as an arcade game. And the bosses are better than they've ever been in Ghosts and Goblins or Ghouls and Ghosts for me. And like, because it is that bit more playable, they can throw a lot more stuff at you and it's not totally overwhelming. I mean, it's definitely a hard game. It's for the fans of the series, but it's brilliant.
Okay, so that's a hell of a new business, Greg.
Yeah, that's just a fraction of like 7 weeks or whatever
it's
been, really.
Just a slice of the Greg Leahy experience. Just a slice.
One day we'll have you back, and I look forward to hearing about all the Xbox games you've been checking out. I know you've checked out a few, but
it's daunting.
It's a hell of a library to just jump into cold.
Especially in the download space. It's ridiculous.
It's exclusively in the download space, apart from maybe Deadly Premonition.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
But, I mean, truth be told, there really isn't a heck of a lot coming out for the 360 from here on out. I mean, if you're not fans of very particular, like, if you're not a Halo fan, probably don't care. There's probably nothing else coming out for you.
I am kind of interested in Halo 4, actually, because I enjoyed Reach well enough, and it looks like they're doing some interesting things with 4. Considering it's called Halo 4, it looks surprisingly fresh and interesting. So,
yeah,
I don't know that I'm going to get it, but I've got my eye on it. So anyway, enough about me. I'm going to talk later. John, why don't you follow up with your new business?
Well, I will continue Greg's PSP theme here with Metal Gear Solid Peace Walker.
Oh, no.
I've had this one in my queue for a while, and I never, you know, I bought it for some, I probably bought it for $10. Like, I buy every PSP game for $10, but I had it in the queue for a while, and I always knew that it was a really good game. When it came out, it was really well reviewed. So I visited the family up in Canada, which, you know, gives me some kind of time away from everything because, you know, my mom doesn't have internet. So pretty much I'm in a little shell there and, you know, away from the world. So I had some time to throw at it. I mean, really, really amazing graphics and sound and all that. certainly does not cut any corners for being on a portable. The interesting thing about it is that you can actually install to your card, so you load off of the UMD less.
Yeah, Tactics Ogre does the same thing.
Yeah.
Even though I don't own a physical UMD, it still has the option there for you to do it.
So if you do it, what does it do? Just go, what the fuck do you want me to do?
It's like crossing the streams, so I'm not trying that.
It installs again.
Yeah, installs it recursively, so the installed version pulls data off the other installed version.
So yeah, so you know, I installed it, and actually it takes up quite a bit of space. I think it takes up about a gig, I think. You can install... It's a pretty chunky install, but it's... Is it worth it? I don't know, because I haven't played it without it, so it probably makes it faster, but who knows.
Fuck it.
So, you know, the controls, of course, the issue with a game like this on PSP is, of course, you don't have two analog sticks, so the controls are always kind of a little bit janky. They're Monster Hunter-ish, I think Monster Hunter, because it's more of an action game and not stealth-based. It hurts you more, because, I mean, you have a choice between, I think, three different layouts, but the one I chose is you aim and kind of move the camera with the face buttons, which is, of course, not as quick as you would want. So aiming is kind of weird, but it's tolerable just because it's more of a stealth game than anything else. A lot of it is kind of sneaking up behind guys and knocking them out and stuff. So it's fine. It doesn't really hurt you very much. Probably hurts you a little bit in boss battles where, you know, you're kind of tasked with reacting more quickly than you are and just kind of sneaking around during the, you know, main chunk of gameplay. But it's not too bad. It's tolerable. Whereas in Monster Hunter, there's times when it's pretty much intolerable. So, you know, still janky controls, but you can handle it. The cutscenes are kind of, they're comic book or, you know, manga kind of cutscenes. Very, very stylized, and they're interactive. You know, you'll see, like, sometimes, like, you know, a helicopter will fly in and you move your RPG over it and click the R button and it shoots down the helicopter sort of thing. But, you know, there's certain things that they kind of make me wonder about it because, you know, so like a lot of the interactive cutscenes, when Snake is talking to some other character, sometimes it'll just kind of throw up sort of a random interactive, like move the analog stick or click, you know, left or right, and something will happen. And in one of the scenes, you know, I'm listening to, you know, him talking to this girl back and forth, and the girl, she was like, you know, laying on the ground, she had been hurt, and for some reason, the interaction was with the left and right D-pad. You could actually zoom in to see through her clothes and see her panties and bra. And that was the interaction. So, like, that was it. There was no purpose to it. It was just there to zoom through her clothes and see her in her bra and panties.
Kojima.
What I remember from all the conversation when this game came out is Snake's really creepy relationship with this relatively young girl in the game.
Well, yeah, because the girl, you know, her name is Paz, Peace, of course. And she's like, I think she's 16.
And this is old Snake too, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah, but he's just, I mean, he's Snake. I mean, the more you listen to that guy's voice, the more hilarious Snake gets.
Oh, yes.
And there's things like, you know, he lights up a Cuban and passes it to her, and they're sitting there, you know, sharing a Cuban cigar. I'm like, where is this going? Or what is this actually? Is there a subtext here that I'm missing? Or, you know, is there something else to this cutscene that, you know, am I supposed to interpret this in some way?
There's the control stuff, but what about full portable play? Is it nicely kind of compartmentalized, kind of like Resident Evil Revelations with the chapters and stuff like that? Because MGS does always see, I've never played any of them. But it seems like, you know, very much the kind of thing you'd want to play for a big session at a time when we're talking about the console stuff, because a fair amount of that might be watching a cutscene.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's one of the best things about it, because that was one of the things going into it. I really didn't really even know what to expect, because I hadn't really read up on the game. You know, I knew that it got good reviews, but people always love, you know, Metal Gear Solid stuff, so I kind of didn't really go by that. And you're absolutely right, Greg. I mean, typically, I was kind of expecting that, you know, they were trying to take the console experience and just slap it on PSP like they do with 99% of the PSP games that are out there. But they really haven't done that. What they do is they allow you to choose your missions, and they don't force you to keep going in the story. So what happens is, the way it's set up is that you have a kind of a home base, which I'll talk about in a second. But so you always return to that home base, and then you can select from the menu whether you want to play the next story mission. And each mission is fairly short and self-contained, so you'll have a very clear objective. Like, you have to go over here and talk to this person, or go over here and knock this person out, or, you know, destroy this tank or something like that. You have one clear objective And once you do that, you're taken back to your home base. And at that point, you can turn the game off, do whatever you want. You're not forced to continue or watch a cutscene or anything like that. Like, you know, there will be a cutscene, but you'll always return to your home base. So that makes it really good for portable play. And then also there's optional missions that you can do that are, you know, stuff like go to a shooting range. Again, self-contained things that, you know, you complete a certain objective or play as long as you feel like, and then you come back in. And one of the key things about the home base is that there's a sort of a resource management aspect to it. So when you're going through a mission, one of the things that you can do is you can knock somebody out, like any of the enemies. You can knock them out and you can tie a balloon to them. They have like some elaborate, like way to explain this away, but you're tying a balloon and you hear a helicopter come over and the guy disappears.
It's science, damn it.
You know, Batman did that, right? In Dark Knight.
It's ridiculous. It's awesome seeing them try to explain it, because even Snake kind of calls it out. He's like, this seems kind of weird. I don't think it's going to work. And the guy back at home base is like, don't worry about it, Snake. Don't worry about it. It's going to work. It's going to be fine. Trust me. And then you finally do it. And he says, see, it turned out great. And Snake's like, you know, Snake is, you know. But
are they like party balloons? Like red and blue? And
yep. They have big hearts on them.
Do they really?
No, no. But actually, you know, something like that, if you could unlock that, that wouldn't surprise me at all.
No, me either. You have to shoot enough frogs, though, to unlock that.
But just one of the balloons says Famitsu and the other says 40 out of 40.
So, but what happens with this whole balloon conceit is that once these guys get airlifted away, they actually get taken back to your home base and then they become part of your private army.
So they brainwashed them somehow, too.
Well, what that allows you to do is you have five different teams, and these are kind of R&D teams where you can assign people to them, and you know they'll make you new guns or improve the guns you have. And same thing with like your rations, with your ammo, with vehicles, whatever. Like, so you have these teams, you know, that you have a medical team, and depending on how good your medical team is, you know, they'll come out of sick bay quicker. And so it's kind of cool though, because, you know, it's, at first I was like, this balloon thing just seems dumb. Why am I doing this? But it actually kind of lets you sort of stock up your army and get better items quicker that you can use in missions, especially the harder ones later on. It kind of helps. But, yeah, there's also a co-op mode, but it's not online. I don't think there's no online. But,
no, it's local only. It was a big hit in Japan. Didn't hear about it much in America.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, very. Yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all. But overall, yeah, I mean, it's really, really good. I mean, anybody that likes the series is going to love it. It's definitely one of the best games for PSP that I've played. It's right up there. And you can get it for pretty cheap. I'm sure you can find it around somewhere. So it's definitely worthwhile.
Cool. So for my new business, I'll start off with a game that I think a lot of our listeners will have some interest in for one reason or another, and that is Penny Arcade on the Rain Slick Precipice of Darkness Episode 3, which is actually one word shorter than the title of the previous game in the series, because they took out Adventures. It was Penny Arcade Adventures.
Well, thank God for that.
And this very minor change in title actually helps set this apart a little bit from the previous games. Once you look at it, there's no mistaking. It's a very different game. It's made by totally different people. It's made by the guys who did Breath of Death 7 and Cthulhu Saves the World, which I gifted to you, James, on Steam. Did you get those?
I did get them. I haven't touched them yet, but
One day you will, and you will love them, because they are hilarious and really fun and a great distillation of the Japanese RPG. I mean, they're sort of a parody of Japanese RPGs, but also a wonderful kind of modernization of those genres. One is sort of 8-bit, one is sort of 16-bit. And this one is very similar to Cthulhu Saves the World. It's kind of a 16-bit style RPG. Of course, it's brand new, but it's very retro in nature. And it looks and plays quite a bit like Final Fantasy V or Final Fantasy VI, sort of a combination of those two. And at a certain point in the game, it also begins to pay tribute to other classic RPGs as well. That's all I will say about it. But it is exactly that. I mean, if you love Final Fantasy IV, V, VI from Super Nintendo, you're going to love this game, because it plays very much like it. It looks very much like it. It's done. It's not just a shameless copy. It's done extremely well with a lot of care. So I'm certainly not through Rain Slick 3, but I can highly recommend it. It's $5. You can get it on Steam or Xbox Live Arcade. Eventually it will be on iOS if you fancy playing a Japanese RPG on your iPhone. I think it sounds horrible, but that will be an option to you at some point. It's really fun. It's very inventive. There's some very clever mechanics that they've thrown into the game. And it's fun to look at, and the writing is just great. So it's co-written by the programmer of the game, Robert Boyd, and Jerry Holkins, Tycho from Penny Arcade. They co-wrote it, and Cthulhu Saves the World, for instance, is a really funny game, and that's without getting Tycho involved. So you can imagine they really kind of take it up a notch in this, and it is really funny and very lovingly written game, but I have to warn you that it is a very, very Tycho game. So just because you love Penny Arcade, the comic, doesn't necessarily mean that this is going to be your cup of tea, because you have to keep in mind that Gabe is a huge contributor, not only to the artwork, but also the writing of that comic strip. I used to remember listening to their podcast when they used to do it. And it was clear that he came up with a lot of the ideas and the language for the comic strips. And Gabe has a very kind of straightforward, more palatable sense of humor, I think. Whereas Tycho, or Jerry, whatever you want to call him, is obviously very wordy guy, very literal guy, and tends to err on the side of complexity in his style of humor. And this game reflects that. So I would say if you love reading the blog posts on Penny Arcade, like the front page, you know, giant essays that Jerry writes three times a week, if you love the sense of humor in that, you're going to like this game. But if you tend to skip over that and go straight to the comic panels, you may not appreciate the writing so much in Rainslick Episode 3. I think you could still enjoy the gameplay a lot if you're into 16-bit RPGs. But the writing is, although really good, also incredibly idiosyncratic. So I just want to warn people that, because you hear people say, oh, it's really funny. It is, if you're into that kind of a thing. But it's a very specific kind of humor. I've also been playing a game on PSN called Dyad, and you've probably heard some stuff about this, and I guess I don't have anything super unique to say about it, so I'll be fairly brief, but as you guys have probably picked up over the years, I really enjoy psychedelic games, and there is a great selection of them on PSN, to Sony's credit. They've done a good job of curating this stuff. And I think the indie game space, you know, the idea of these sort of cheaper $5, $10, $15 games that are made by small amounts of people that need less marketing and they can appeal to a more niche audience, I also think that is a great opportunity for these games to really stretch the bounds of what a game can look like and also what it can be in terms of design. Dyad is a game that the design of it is, while not conventional, it is not especially complicated or, you know, really boundary breaking, but it looks so crazy. I mean, the idea is that you're going through this tube and you're sort of rotating the tube around your little character to hook onto little enemies and race past them and pick up power-ups and get on certain zip lines so you can go faster. And it's a really fast game, and it gets faster and faster and faster as you go through it. But the game is so psychedelic and just hallucinatory in the visual presentation that after a while it becomes increasingly difficult to discern what's actually going on in the levels. And that's an intentional design decision. It's part of the difficulty of playing the game. It's also part of the skill that you build up as you play it more and more and learn to get better at it, is you learn to parse out what's important, what's not important in the game based on increasingly little visual input. And, you know, Dyad, like, supposedly takes place in this kind of tube, like I said, but...
Oh, it's tube sliders.
Yeah, I did think of tube sliders, actually. I really did. Because it is a kind of a racing game. It's a quasi... You're not really racing against anyone else, but you're racing against the clock.
That's okay. Tube sliders is only a racing game in that they were trying to race F-Zero to get out.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, Tube Sliders is actually probably the single closest comparison to this game. The problem is no one actually played Tube Sliders, so it's a totally nope. useless point of comparison.
Oh, but James will never let us forget. Well, gee, no, there's a record for jokes made about a single game.
It is a hilarious title.
Never forget.
Anyway, Dyad is just such a crazy game. I mean, it gets to a point where it... You no longer really see the tube because the graphics on the screen are just so...
The tube is invisible!
No, but it really does feel like that.
It's in your mind!
It's, you know, and I've talked about how I love the sequence at the end of 2001, A Space Odyssey, and this is the closest you will ever see in a video game to that sequence, because it is that insane looking. And after a while, you start to question, what is that color? Like, it's five colors all blended together, and they're flashing and strobing and rotating around, and it's like, it just becomes...
If this were a box game, I would insinuate they put something in it.
Yeah, really.
The visual design, it starts to get so blurry, and I don't mean literally blurry like it looks like a bad N64 game, but I mean all the visual elements, all the colors and lines and shapes, they start to become intentionally sort of blurred together to a point where it's this kind of mush on the screen. And the beauty of the game is that by that point, they've trained you to have at least a fighting chance of still understanding what's going on despite all of that stuff. And it's one of those games where if someone just walked in the room and saw you playing it, they'd be like, dude, what the hell is going on? Like, is the Riddler controlling you through the screen? What are you doing? Is that a game? Why are you holding a controller? How could you possibly understand what is on the screen right now? But because it builds up to that slowly over time, you do kind of understand. I mean, you don't fully understand it, but you understand it just enough to get through. And it's an interesting skill to teach someone. It's like we've discussed it before with Smash Brothers, how the game is so visually overwhelming at first that understanding what's on the screen and being able to pick out the details and follow the action is itself a skill that's very important to playing the game. And I think Dyad does the same thing, but just in a very different way.
So what is the significance of the title? Because, I mean, the term itself references pairs, essentially.
Yes. The very core gameplay mechanic, there are many perturbations of this and power-ups and special enemies and special mechanics that they add on top of it. But the very core mechanic of the game is you have a little targeting reticule out in front of your character that targets enemies as they come up in the level. And the enemies have colors, and when you push a button, you hook onto one of the enemies, which gives you a little bit of a speed boost. And so you want to hook onto pairs of enemies of the same color.
Okay.
Which becomes difficult once the colors are no longer definable.
Once the fumes start to kick in.
It's a really cool game. I mean, it's $15. I'd say if you're not into really crazy psychedelic games, $15 is maybe a bit of a stretch because it is very simple. But if you like this sort of thing, I like this a lot better than Rez, but I think the problem is Rez is too simple mechanically. Like, it feels like you're barely playing the game.
Well, I mean, Rez is kind of like tune in, drop out. I mean, it really is.
Where Dyad is very much more mentally engaging because it is actually a somewhat difficult game, and it has very complex mechanics that you're trying to keep in the back of your head, but at the same time, you really need to get into that Tetris zone where you're not really thinking about what's happening. You're just doing it. You're just doing what you need to do. And trying to get into that zone with all this crazy shit going on. I mean, visually, it's the total opposite of Tetris. It's just the most insane thing you could imagine. That is a really interesting combination. And it doesn't always work for me. It's kind of on a level by level basis, depending on just how complicated they make the action, how complicated they make the visuals. But when it really hits the sweet spot, it's a pretty amazing experience. So I'm definitely enjoying it. And then finally, I'll talk briefly about a very brief game called Dear Esther. I got this as Have you heard of it, James?
A little bit.
It's a curiosity. That's for sure. It's a PC game. Although I think game is debatable in this case. I think it's a game, but you'll probably get a lot of arguments from people who say it. They don't think it is.
It's experimental is the term they use for it.
Yeah. I mean, it launched at $10. During Steam sale, it was $250.
Which is more commensurate with the game itself.
Maybe so. I got it as a gift, actually, although I was going to buy it for myself. And right before, I actually had it in my shopping cart on Steam during the sale when I got notification that a friend had bought it for me. So thank you very much, Kevin. I played through it last weekend. I really enjoyed it, actually. It's a very strange kind of artsy project that I think only one or two people worked on. And it looks like a first-person shooter. It's in a first-person view, but you don't have a gun. There's nothing in front of you. There's actually no way to manually interact with the game, with the world at all. There are no guns. There's no pickaxe. There's no gravity tool. You never pick anything up. You never pull a lever or push a button. There are no enemies in the game. There's no combat whatsoever. There's no UI. There's no health meter. which is nice because it actually gives you just a better view of the world. And the graphics are very beautiful on my, at least on my gaming PC. It looks wonderful. And it's really just a storytelling device. There's an interesting story here. It's a very unconventional story, I would say. A little bit like, maybe Memento, you know, if you're really into that kind of storytelling where things are revealed sort of almost retroactively to you as the story goes on, and that you've got a character who is maybe may or may not be mentally stable. You're not really sure. You're sort of seeing things through the main character's perspective, and the main character is unreliable. All of these things play into it. So it's a very non-linear kind of story that you're picking up. But the idea is you're on this island and you're walking around. And as you walk around, you sort of explore the island. As you walk to different parts of the island, you hear this voice, and it may or may not be the character that you're controlling, but this voice tells a story, except he's not really telling a story. He's just sort of saying things. And over time, the things that he says sort of add up into a story, but kind of very loosely. And you start to slowly piece together, why are you on this island? What is this island? Who else has been there? What happened in this character's past? What's torturing him? What's he going to do about it? What is the whole point of all this, and where are you headed? So the game sort of very subtly funnels you towards a destination over the course of it. And why are you going there? Where are you going? What are you going to do when you get there? All this stuff is sort of slowly revealed to you in just the most roundabout, tangential way you could imagine. It's very interesting storytelling. But again, I would say this is a game in the sense that, you know, it sort of challenges you to think about how you interact with it. Because you're really just walking around, and yet you still got things like there are goals and objectives, although they're sort of implied, and there is a sort of sense of you being funneled and being directed by the people who made this game, even though you could defy that and go the opposite way.
It's pretty much Black Ops, basically.
but anyway, the whole thing is like 90 minutes long. If you're not interested in a kind of artsy, experimental storytelling project, then don't play Dear Esther. But if you are, I think it's really cool. It's really interesting. It's not very expensive. And it's sort of this memorable little short trip through madness. And you can't fail. You may not ever finish it, but you certainly can't fail it.
My exposure to this game has been that it basically reawakened a new battle in the utterly pointless war of the debate of what is a game.
Yeah.
And of course, the battle remains unresolved.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things that's, it may be fun for some people to talk about, but it's sort of beside the point. Dear Esther is a thing that you can purchase and run on your computer, and you can experience it for yourself. And I think it's worth doing so, whether it's a game or not. It's a thing that is worth experiencing, much like a movie. So that's my new business. James, why don't you wrap up this extended feature?
So yes, I'll start with an update. So last we spoke, 2 weeks ago, I had picked up Tales of the Abyss and had dropped, I don't know, what was like 13, 14 hours into it at that point. So we're now week three, we're reaching the end of week three, and I'm at 40 hours.
This is fairly slow progress for you.
It's not super fast. I mean, it's a couple hours a day, but yeah. It's really in fits and starts. You know, I'll play 10 minutes, 20 minutes. I'll set it down, come back, play another 10 minutes, play 20 minutes before bed, stuff like that. You know, it's a Tales game through and through at this point. You know, I'm very much familiar with what the game expects me to do. It does feel a bit older, which makes sense because it came out in 05, I think.
On PS2.
There are a lot of quirks of the game that I know have been fixed in subsequent games in the series. One of the more notable ones is that a lot of times the game will tell you where you need to go once, which was probably okay on the PS2, but on a handheld game where you can just close the lid,
right?
That's kind of an issue.
I found that as well. The other thing is they'll tell you, hey, let's go to this one town. But they won't even tell you, hey, it's sort of in the northwest, or hey, it's at a bay. Like even some kind of graphical hint of which one of the 12 places I can visit that it is.
They usually say, let's go to Doth, okay? It's west of here. We're on the east side of the map. Fuck you.
Yeah.
So you start just hitting each harbor, and you can't even go straight into the towns, which is sort of a quirk of this particular game. A lot of the towns require you to go to bays and harbors and then go to the city
on foot. Yeah, and then traverse another long distance.
That does get rectified later in the game, but relatively much later. Like hour 34 of my quest into 40. Now keep in mind, I'm in hour 40 and I'm in the last third of the games. I'm probably about halfway through the last third of the game. So there's still a significant portion of game to go. And Tails games tend to slow down at the end while you're doing side quest wrap up and trying to pick up some levels for that final boss. There's actually quite a lot of mini quests in the game too, which I'm quite happy with. But yeah, I mean, it's a good game for a 3DS in that it's a lot of content. It's easily my top played 3DS game at this point, although it's still getting its ass handed to it by the Netflix hours. But beyond that, it's the second most used title on my 3DS. And because of the fact that closing the lid doesn't reset the timer, according to my 3DS stats thing, I play it on average about 26 hours in a shot.
Not entirely unrealistic for you, though, James. Let's be honest.
Oh, that's interesting. See, this is a clue as to how you and I play games so differently, James, because even on 3DS, I would never play a single game for that long of a time without interrupting it with something else on the system.
See, I'll have other systems going, but I tend to keep to one game per system at a time.
Yeah.
But I'm enjoying it. It's good to have that kind of beefy experience on the 3DS. So I'm happy with the purchase. I also, as most of our listeners are probably aware, they're all relatively engaged gamers. And Johnny's already alluded to it. The Steam sale happened.
Oh boy, did it ever.
Yeah, so I went possibly slightly crazy during the Steam sale and bought a handful of indie packs, usually for just one game, and but said it's only $2 to get the rest of them.
Oh, James. Lindemann syndrome striking. It's amazing.
I'll play them. I'm already on game 4, so I might have a little leg up on you, John. It's like, gee, I really only want Frozen Synapse, but I'll take this oil rig simulator game that comes with it.
It's called Burning Synapse.
Oh. So that's one of the games I'm going to talk about. I played Frozen Synapse, which, if you're not familiar with this game, it's kind of a weird strategy game where you have this very like Tron-looking room that you have an overhead view of, and you control a handful of specialized combat units, and you basically map out their actions and hit next turn. And their job is to basically clear out the enemies. It's a lot like
XCOM, is what I heard.
Yeah, it's a lot like XCOM. It's a little bit different in how the turns work to an extent. But there's a lot of having to anticipate what your opponents are going to do on that turn. And usually the objectives can be maddeningly difficult. So I actually really enjoy the game because to me it bears a lot of resemblance to programming. It's very process-oriented programming going on. So, you know, you have to map out a bunch of individual steps your character will take on this turn. And then you sort of hit play and preview what they're going to do. And, you know, then you map out the other characters and you're trying to make these processes interact with each other and interact with the objective. And there's a certain amount of, you know, anticipation you have to put into it. You have to sort of come up with what your cases can be. And there's a lot of environmental interaction. So to an extent, it really engages the same part of my brain that kicks in when I'm trying to solve a relatively difficult programming problem. The downside with this is that it means that if the game throws in some sort of randomized behavior that you don't understand, it can be absolutely maddening.
Oh, yeah.
Which it does. And you sit there and you think, I've got this. And then you realize, wait, he could just take like two steps over and just shoot all the way down that hallway and just mace the guy I'm trying to protect.
Oh, there's nothing worse than a game that appears to be deterministic but actually isn't.
Right.
So when you do something and you've been trained to expect a certain response and then the game fucks with you and it does something that you didn't see coming, it can be a delight depending on the context.
Right.
But in this kind of game, it's usually just maddening.
Because it's restart. Restart the whole mission.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting about the game is that when you're playing it, the computer's doing the exact same thing you're doing. So you map out your moves, the computer maps out their moves, and you can see that the computer isn't taking your input into account, even though it knows it. Because I've had characters, basically, I gave my character a walk command, pointed him in a direction and said, walk. And the computer did the same thing with theirs, and they ran into each other. Back to back. So they weren't even shooting. They just bumped into each other and stopped. And I was like, well, computer didn't take my input into account. So then the next turn, we both turned around and both started shooting because we both said, well, that's the obvious answer for this. And we both ended up getting gunned down in the hallway. But what is difficult for me on this game is that for whatever reason, it is incredibly processor intensive when it's computing what the AI should do. And on my laptop, the relatively graphically unintensive game runs just fine. Until I get to the phase between turns, which seems like it can go on forever while the computer determines what it wants to do. And it really has made it difficult for me to enjoy the game fully, especially because relatively quickly the game can become maddening. And you've got these characters talking to you about this completely ass-bending story that makes no sense. And they're like, well, this mission should be easy. I'm like, fuck you, this is the 13th time you've told me this mission will be easy. I don't want to hear it. I'm going to have to wait 2 minutes between turns while you tell me this is easy. Don't need that. So the wait time was so interminable that I was playing Tales of the Abyss during the time between turns.
Nice.
It was horrible.
Playing two games at once.
So I'm going to probably shelf this game, even though I really like it, until I get a proper PC in here to run it on.
Yeah.
Which sucks, because there's no reason it should take this long. And in fact, I got the expansion pack with the game as part of the Steam sale, and that seems to run faster, but it's much more difficult. So there's a lot of little pieces that you have to sort of keep in mind as you map out your stuff, and I find that really, really engaging. And I'm surprised there aren't more games like that, because it's really sort of engaging the same sort of emotions people who make games get engaged in while they practice their craft.
Oh yeah, programming can be fun. If you get into the right zone, and if you're doing stuff that is challenging enough without being super frustrating and roadblocking you,
yeah,
it definitely hits you in that part of the brain that video games sometimes do.
So, to go from the opposite extreme, another, I mean, it's not quite an indie game, but it's got the same indie vibe. I got, for incredibly cheap, Star Wars Republic Commando, which is a very indie franchise if you think about it, which was originally a PC and Xbox game from 2006, something like that.
Really? That recently? It seems
like... It was a very late Xbox game.
Huh.
I got it for like $3 during the Steam sale. It was like nothing. So, you know, I was like, well, that's less than lunch. Bought. And actually, it runs quite well on my relatively meager laptop. And I found that it very much feels like a product of old hallway design shooters. You know, it is a first-person shooter. It's very flashy. They stole the head visor straight out of Metroid. But it's very much the old corridor-style shooter versus the open areas kind of on a line that we get in a lot of first-person shooters now. So it's a lot of hallways and branching things and confined spaces. And it's the first Star Wars game based on the new movies where the enemies actually feel, well, obviously you're a Republic Commando, which means you're a Special Forces person. It's the first game where you actually feel like, oh shit, son, this is actual war. Because even in the Battlefront games, the droids went down really easy. Like, you shot them and the whole spaceship blew up. It's like, well, my hand blaster is really powerful. But in this game, like, it legitimately feels like you are crawling the crap through just horrible, horrible odds and just having to get three other really specialized units that are sort of under your command to work properly. So you're giving them orders on where to go to in the middle of firefights and trying to keep them safe during objectives. I mean, it feels dated because of the design conceits that went into, like, level design, and graphically it's not super great. But there's just something rewarding about how the squad mechanic works out, because you do have four very specialized units that each have very specialized personalities, even though they're clones, that are incredibly well voice acted, actually. And their interaction, both in terms of gameplay-wise and in terms of just – it feels like what a company of really elite soldiers would probably be yelling to each other in the middle of just completely ridiculous odds and completely stupid objectives they've been given. I mean, they're openly making jokes about the fact, well, I'm going to get killed here. Or just completely random things that they're seeing, or you know, there's a little bit of the Army of Two going on. Like, you shoot off a robot's head and then they'll make jokes about it. It's really kind of an enjoyable ride for what it is.
I've got one question about it.
Sure.
Do you get to execute Order 66?
I haven't yet, but I just cleared the Battle of Geonosis, so there's some time left.
No, there's a lot of time left. No.
Yeah, I think it's got three discrete campaigns, and except we just finished Geonosis, which is it's actually a really long battle. I mean, it's basically from the landing to the point they've cleared out the planet, which, as you can imagine, they're wiping out the indigenous race and a bunch of fucking robots. It takes a while. I mean, it takes a long time. I mean, you're going like deep into the core of the planet to find hidden robot factories. I mean, it gets crazy hard in there. I actually really enjoyed it.
Well, that's cool. By the way, James, I didn't ask you to bring this data, but what would you estimate you spent on the Steam sale, and how many games did you get for it?
I can tell you exactly. I spent a little over $12.
Oh, that's not much.
I got, if you want to count Frozen Synapse and its add-on as separate games, about 11 games.
For $12?
Yes.
That's amazing. That's pretty impressive, man. So I spent considerably more than you. I spent $60, roughly $60 on the Steam sale, and I got for that 10 games. But a lot of the, I didn't really buy any, I think I bought one or two, what you could really call indie games, like, you know, really cheap things. I didn't buy any packs.
Yeah, see, I bought the packs. That's what got
everything
me.
I bought was a la carte. Because I don't want to end up with a bunch of games that I know literally I will never play because I never intended to play them in the first place. I always want to make sure that the games I have are at least, I might play them one day because I do at least want to play them one day.
Yeah, like I figured, I'll try the oil simulator at some point. I mean, come on. It could at least be good for a laugh to talk about on the show.
Yeah. I picked up at least two games that were originally $60 retail. And they're fairly recent games as well. So I got really good deals on those. And then I picked up a few other ones that were originally, you know, $15, $20, $25, got them all for way less. So I actually picked up some pretty notable, really good games. I'm not going to go through the list because they'll eventually become the backbone of my new business until Wii U comes out probably. But, I feel like I got some pretty good stuff. At the same time, just to tell you how desperate my backlog is becoming on Steam, especially, I am currently playing or have recently played three different games on Steam. Dear Esther, Rainslick 3, talked about both of those. And then also I've started playing through Deus Ex Human Revolution, which seems really good. I'll bring it back up in a couple of weeks. None of those were games that I bought on the Steam sale.
And that's funny because Deus Ex Human Revolution had a huge discount on the Steam sale.
It did, but it also had a huge discount the last time they did a sale and that's when I bought it. So it's been sitting there for like 6 months. So I finally started playing that. So of the 10 games that I bought on the Steam sale, over a week later, I still haven't actually played a single one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I got some work to do.
I spent $20 on four games.
Yeah, that's pretty modest action for you, John.
Yeah, it was relatively modest.
All right, so that's going to wrap up new business finally. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have a bit of listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with a new slate of virtual console recommendations by Zach, Andy and Neil. So Sword of Hope 2 is a collection of menus, Kirby's Pinball Land is just that, and Tumble Pop is a thing that you can find more about by reading the recommendation. And finally, Kid Icarus of Myths and Monsters is for some reason regarded as recommended for everyone. It's a trend! And next up we have video from Ariel Ruff and Jared Rosenberg on a duo of Ubisoft developer demos for Rabbids Land and Rayman Legends. Ubisoft launch titles, not just 5-year-old PS2 ports anymore.
Next up, we've got a feature called the Great Pre-Wii U Backlog, led up by Carmine Red and featuring much of the staff. Those members of the staff who don't play with a pie, excepting John Lindemann, are making an effort to rectify their dereliction. The documentation of their journeys will both excite and horrify. Also, it will probably make you consider contacting a financial planner.
Always wise.
This feature is amazing if only because it includes photographic evidence of the backlogs, and you will cower in fear when you see these photos. And we also have a review for Rhythm Thief and the Emperor's Treasure by Alex Calafi. Sega has finally decided to release Michael Jackson the Experience 3DS on American shores. Alex isn't as enamored with a smooth criminal, fretting that the game is good at everything except being a good rhythm game.
All right, we have a feature, Getting to Know Your Super Mario Bros. 2 Directors by Neil Ronahan. And Neil dares to answer the question nobody is asking. Who the heck are Yusuke Amano and Masaki Ishikawa? Sadly, this team couldn't override Tezuka's gold fever. And we have another feature, The Next Zelda by Zach and James. Miyamoto has stated that he isn't sure which Zelda would be a better candidate for a 3DS remake, Majora's Mask or A Link to the Past. According to James, his answer is the correct one.
Following up, we have a review for Heroes of Ruin by Patrick Barnett. This sword-swinging, character-customizing, loot-looting, online-playing dungeon crawler from NWR favorite developer, InSpace, is a lot of game in a 3DS-sized package, and it turns out it's pretty good. And finally, we have a blog called Kirby's Dream Collection Special Edition Unboxing by Danny Bivens. He unboxed a ROM collection. I'm just soaking in that fact. However, Nintendo did a great job putting together a commemorative box set for Mario's anniversary. Actually, they didn't, but they did for Kirby. See what Japanese Kirby fans get in the fully inflated edition of Dream Collection. Oh, dear. Yep, so obviously we have a lot of great content. We might even be catching up a little from last week here in Now Playing, and you can check all of it out over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show. Unfortunately, James's power cut out during the break, so he will not be joining us, as far as I know. It sounds like it's not coming back on anytime soon. So in the meantime, the three remaining crew here, including our special guest Greg Leahy, will be answering your listener mail, and the address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And Greg has the first email.
Yes, Ryan writes, "Hey Johnny, I sent you an email about your stolen 3DS earlier and something else has occurred to me. You might want to talk to the local police department where you live. Although the incident didn't take place in their jurisdiction, they might humour you and take a courtesy report for the other PD. Normally that kind of thing is done for more critical incidents, but it doesn't hurt to try. It's not like it's a lot of work for them. You fill out a statement, bring your 3DS serial number if you still have it, and if your agency is anything like mine, they'll mail the courtesy report to the other agency. There's really no damn reason you need to go down there in person. So ridiculous. I hope my advice helps."
Well, thank you very much, Ryan. And this is really a personal email, but I wanted to share it on the show because I thought this might help other people who are in a similar situation or who may one day get themselves into a similar situation.
It does make you think, if we get to a point where people are loading up their 3DS systems with the premium download games that are also available at retail, whether it will in fact completely kill Street Pass, that no one will take the 3DS anywhere with them anymore because they'll be too nervous about losing it.
Well, I think XL's gonna damage Street Pass as well. Just not as portable.
Yeah.
I'll still have it at PAX, but I'm probably not going to stick it in my pocket for a jog like I would with the old 3DS. So the other thing is this email was kind of a good entry point for me to give a little bit of an update. I still don't have a 3DS. I still don't have a police report because, as Ryan alludes to, I didn't have really a way to get to the local precinct where I believe the thing took place. But, you know, I was thinking about it, and I think Ryan's suggestion is very logical, which doesn't necessarily mean it will, you know, pay dividends in the real world, but it is very logical because I might not have realized my 3DS had been stolen until I got back. It might have been stolen at the airport or somewhere where I don't know the exact moment it happened, and so there's no way for me to go back to that location and file the report. So it might make sense for me to do it here anyway. I could claim that I lost it on my way back. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to lie to the police, but they really have no way of verifying where it happened anyway, because I don't know where it happened. So it really doesn't make sense that I would have to report this in the place where I lost it.
Yeah. I mean, I remember at E3 many years back, somebody had their laptop stolen out of their suitcase, right?
Yes. As my friend Matt Hogan, he checked his laptop, which you should never do.
Yeah.
Ever. A baggage handler at the airport between Alabama and LA stole it, just opened it up, took the laptop out, closed the bag, and it was never seen again. And we got to E3 and realized this fact. And of course, he was distraught. And I had some things stolen as well that were worth a lot less money. It was a lot of GameCube controllers and GameCube discs that I had brought with me. Anyway, we got there, we looked over the fine print, we tried to call and lodge a complaint and say, "Hey, your employee stole our shit." And the airline told us that they are not responsible for anything worth over, actually the value is irrelevant, they are not liable for loss of electronics in your checked luggage. And that is, as far as I know, that is still true today, over 10 years later. And that's why you should never, ever check electronics or any valuable jewelry falls under the same policy. You should never check anything valuable in your luggage. It's a shitty policy. It's a great reason to never check a bag again if you can help it, especially considering they actually charge you money to do so now.
Yeah. Furthermore, they can just destroy your bag and really not give a shit about it.
So anyway, the police report thing, I thought that was a really good piece of advice. I haven't had time to go try that yet. Maybe this weekend I can. I'd like to give it a shot. Because again, I'm not getting that 3DS back. Somebody at this point has found it and decided to keep it. Obviously, they, you know, it would not be that difficult to trace it back to me, especially considering I left my information with the lost and found at the venue. So, I'm not getting it back, but I might, if I get the police report and go through all these hoops, I might still have a chance at getting my licenses. And by the way, if anyone was angered about my insinuation, I was going to try to use my special connections with Nintendo to get this done. Nintendo came back and said, actually, you're going to have to go through customer service. We don't really, like, our PR agency doesn't really have the power to do that anyway. So all my connections amounted to nothing. Customer service doesn't give a hoot what website I work for. They don't really care. So, I'm going to have to go through them anyway if I ever have a chance. And to do that, I'm going to have to get a police report. So I wanted to share this piece of advice for anybody who might, have the misfortune of being in the same situation. As it is, I've decided that I'm definitely waiting until the XL, because at this point, it's only like 3 weeks away anyway. I can wait that long. I got plenty of stuff I can do until then. So, I'm going to wait, get the XL, and then hopefully at that point, contact Nintendo customer service and try to get my licenses ported over. I don't think there's any harm in waiting because, again, they don't know how long it's been since I lost it, and they really shouldn't care.
Yeah, I think GameStop has some deal where if you buy a 3DS XL, you get a free game. I saw that.
Really? Well, maybe I'll do that. The thing that does concern me is I'm pretty sure I will have to mail in my XL for customer service to install the licenses on it.
That sucks. That really, really sucks.
I don't think there's a remote way for them to do it. So I'm going to get my brand new system, and you know, luckily they're really fast about that kind of thing usually. Anyway, that's the update on the trials and tribulations of owning digital stuff on your 3DS. Ladies and gentlemen, James Jones is back.
I'm back from the heart of darkness.
You recovered the power. You put the wires on your tongue.
I was just picturing James like Doc Brown at the end of the first Back to the Future, just struggling to get those two things together.
So how much of a story do you want? Because it involves the phrase line workers and strip club.
Whoa.
I'd like to keep that cryptic. And not, everyone can have their own interpretation of that.
We can talk about that later, James.
So, yeah, James is back, and John's going to read the next letter.
The Fleece writes, "We know New Super Mario Bros. 2 is going to be the first game available for download on the 3DS. Do you think that will be the only game out that day, or could there possibly be other titles available like some of the 3DS launch games? Can we expect every future 3DS title to be available for download, or will only first-party titles get this treatment?"
Can I answer the second question first? Because I know definitively the answer to that part.
Please.
So, multiple sources have confirmed to outlets that, quote, "you would be crazy not to take advantage of the download service because the cut you're getting is much better than when you do the cartridge."
I bet.
So third parties will be on the service, and in fact, Nintendo has incentivized it in such a way that, as I said, you would be crazy not to be. Now, not all third parties may do it on game launch. It may not be day and date. It depends on what each publishing house is capable of. Like, it might be more difficult for some than others.
It depends on how difficult Nintendo has made that process. I mean,
yeah.
You have to send the code to Nintendo to get it manufactured on the card anyway, so presumably they take that same code and just put it on a server.
It may not be the same code, though. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how the thing works. It could be you have to compile the code differently.
Hmm.
It could be something that menial. It may be that some games will come day and date, but I imagine that most will be available on the download service because apparently it's very hard incentivized for you to do so. Now, and for Nintendo, that doesn't really make a big difference because they're probably just giving the publishers the cut that they took before that was their cost in producing the cartridge. So they probably just said, okay, you can keep that part. We'll keep everything else, but you can have the cartridge cut.
Oh, yeah. They're still getting their license fee.
Yeah.
But there's just a fixed cost that Nintendo doesn't really – I doubt that Nintendo really makes a profit on manufacturing cards. I think that's just part of the business that they have to take care of. So I think they're fine saying, but we'll just manufacture less cards. We weren't really making big bucks on it anyway. It was just something that needed to be done.
And it's not just the cards. It's the packaging. It's the shipping of the stuff. Nintendo does all that because they have to ship it out from their warehouses to the publishers.
Yeah, but this will affect, in the long term at least, maybe not right off the bat, but eventually it will affect how many cards get made, because there will be less need, and you don't want to make a lot more cards than you're going to sell.
Especially since many of the 3DS cards are not custom sizes, but there are many sizes available to publishers, and they appear to be more or less ordered a la carte.
Well, the process, the manufacturing, like, allocation type stuff for making those cards is gotten much better than it used to be, like in the Super Nintendo and N64 days, you know, where you had to order this stuff like a year in advance. You had to order at least 500,000 copies, and, you know, you had to pay for it all up front, and then you had to eat the costs if the games didn't sell. So I think they're capable of making them in much smaller batches now, and much more on demand. They're also quicker about making them.
Well, and the cards are much less customized than they were. Like, during the Super Nintendo, it was the fucking Wild West in terms of what the cards were made of.
Oh, like putting processors on the chip and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was just chaos zone in there. And I think now it's much more standardized. It's much easier. I mean, those cards are a lot simpler than a Super Nintendo card. There is not much to them.
Yeah.
There is silicon and a battery, and that's pretty much it. And if you open up like a Super Nintendo cart, there's a lot of crap going on inside that thing.
Yeah, they're like small circuit boards.
They are. They really are. So to an extent, Nintendo could give those publishers that money or just not charge them that money, and it really is no skin off their back. They still make the same profit.
Right, and then that becomes margin for them to discount the game and yet still make a profit, just a smaller profit.
Right, and that does appear to be in the making, our discounts. You know, Nintendo said they'll have the ability to charge what they want for these retail games.
Mm-hmm.
So we will see third-party games on this service. Third parties have already been speaking about it somewhat clandestinely. Now, in terms of day and date with New Super Mario Bros. 2, I would not be surprised in the slightest if that game is the only game out there on day one, if only because Nintendo wants to spotlight it.
Well, I mean, yeah. We're really close to the Japanese release date. In fact, they've already had, like, the retail cards with the codes on it, like, are already in the stores or whatever. But that day, you've got New Super Mario Bros. 2 and the Demon Brain Training or whatever.
Oni Training. Yeah.
Only Training. So, like, those are both new games. I don't think we've heard anything about digital releases of old previously released games coming at the same time. So I assume it's just going to be those two kind of kicking it off there. And then in the other territories, it seems like it's just going to be New Super Mario Bros. 2, at least initially.
And I expect Nintendo will put things like Steel Diver out there eventually. I mean, there's no reason for them not to.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that there's a certain amount of money there to be made, isn't it? I mean, even if it's not terribly much, you would think that, for instance, there's a certain amount of like early DS games that did not have demand that would have brought about another print run or something, but you would see them kind of trade around on eBay for quite a lot of money because people still wanted them, but they weren't so easy to get. And I think Super Princess Peach probably falls into this category.
Yeah, that was the game I was about to mention. That game is worth Tetris DS is worth a ton of money.
Well, Tetris has got the whole licensing thing about, like, they probably would have wanted to do another run of that, but they couldn't. Whereas, like, with Princess Peach, you know, I guess they just chose not to. And the point is, instead of people getting some of that money when they resell the game on eBay, in the future, you know, we might expect that kind of transaction to happen through the eShop, and then Nintendo can actually pocket that.
It'll be like when Radiant Silvergun came out on 360 and the price of that game went down, because now you could play that game without paying $1 million to some collector in with a really shady eBay record.
Overnight, there are infinite Radiant Silverguns.
I suppose the question's going to be, though, in terms of going back and putting whether it would be previously released 3DS games, maybe even they will do DS games at some point.
Which I actually mentioned on one of our pre-E3 episodes. I thought they'd do DS games. I'm still annoyed.
It begs the question, though, considering how they kind of have this philosophy of maintaining a certain kind of flow of releases on digital stores that's quite slow, where would they fall? How different would they be? I mean, if you've got stuff that's coming out now, then you can anchor it to the retail release, so there's a reason to kind of do that. Whereas if it's at Nintendo's discretion because it's already been out, it could take a long time for them to kind of build up those libraries.
Nintendo wants to convert their customers to this model because for them it means more money as well, and it cuts the used sales market gone.
Yeah, you've got that, but it also takes some of the risk out of the equation. Right. I think that's always a big thing.
So Nintendo absolutely needs to do whatever they can to incentivize the adoption of this marketplace, and that means getting rid of the anemic release schedule they've had for digital platforms heretofore at this point. That means they need to be pounding that thing, and they do need to release things at such a rate that they do potentially risk crowding some games, because they need that marketplace to be absolutely thriving. They just need to make sure there's reason for you to go in there every day and see what's come out.
Dude, what future are you living in where Nintendo releases a game a day?
I realize that they won't. Well, I mean,
that will never, ever happen.
I realize that, but I mean, if they just need people to have a reason to continually go back and check, and just checking each Thursday and seeing, oh, they've put out another pinball game. Okay.
What would be really nice if they had, like, Mondays are for DS games, and Tuesdays are for new 3DS games, and Wednesdays are for virtual console
you
games.
You shielded this idea before. yeah, I mean, it would be good, but then they'd have to put out a press release every day, and I can't stand to read their press releases as much as they come out as it is.
I think it's interesting to look at how other people have done this, especially in the console market, because you've got the PS2 games that are being released on PS3 for download, because PS2 has one of the largest libraries ever of any platform.
It's basically like NES, Game Boy, PS2 in terms of the platform sizes.
Yeah, I want to say there's still only like a dozen, maybe 20 games on PS2 that you can download through PS3. And that service has been up there for like a year. So they'll release two or three at a time, but it feels like they only do it like every month or two.
It's a little odd, wasn't it? It's actually been far more prolific of all the places in the world, in Europe, funnily enough. That
really?
It's the one place they've run quite a lot of PS2 games. There's still not that many, obviously a tiny, tiny slice of the platform's huge software library, but there is more. And they've only just started doing it, like, I think this week in Japan. It's like the first few PS2 games are going up, which is really weird because the PS1 library in Japan is so impressive and frightening compared to everywhere else.
It really is. Huge. It's overwhelming.
I think part of it is because of the fact that you could play those games on PSP, which is a big deal. Mm-hmm. In Japan, whereas of course you won't be able to play the PS2 classics on your PSP, and I don't think there's anything about playing them on Vita yet or anything like that.
I think, well, they just started supporting PS1 games on the Vita, which should have been there from the first day, but whatever. They finally get caught up to the PSP, and they finally let you do that. I think, though, eventually there will be support for playing PS2 games on Vita. I think it's certainly powerful enough to do that.
You would think so, yeah. But I mean, for now, I think the point is maybe that's why there's such a big disparity between what there's so many PS1 games and not so many PS2 games, because maybe that whole market is actually driven by the handheld players rather than like the PS3 gamers, because it is Japan, as we know. But it's just an interesting sort of difference to note between the regions for whatever reason. But I mean, I think some of the suggestion why that's maybe been a bit slow, that's, I think, Eurogamer, the Digital Foundry, they just did a piece on this, is actually that they've been finding the emulation quite challenging.
I can see that, though. I mean, it's...
obviously, backwards compatibility with PS3 has had quite a sordid sort of history.
If they hadn't shredded the backwards compatibility, it'd be much easier, certainly.
But, I mean, go back to the 3DS situation. I think the good thing is that there isn't really some huge 3DS back catalogue for Nintendo to, like, pick through of games that have already been released. You know, the system hasn't been on sale that long, and we were all, you know, there was the whole thing about the phone, oh, God, there's no games coming out for it, you know, during quite a few of those months. So even if they were doing the drip feed of older games up for download, they could probably get all the major titles before too long. I just wonder whether they'll give a period of time to sort of associate it strictly with newer games, and then perhaps bring in the catalogue over time, be very gradual about it.
I also wonder if they maybe have an agreement with retailers to wait, if they do have a strategy for this. Because you got to think, this would scare retailers, because retailers still have stock in 3DS games that aren't selling very well. And if you then go and put those games on the eShop for a pretty severe discount, I mean, Steel Diver, I'd pay $5 for it. It's 12 on Amazon for a brand new copy, so Nintendo's not making any more money on that.
It's $5 at Best Buy, by the way, Steel Diver.
Oh, really? If I had a 3DS, I might pick it up.
That's what I thought you were referring to. I'm like, yeah, it actually is $5 at Best Buy.
Remember, Nintendo's commentary, though, was they weren't going to undercut retailers on their stuff. Now, other publishers might.
But on archival releases, you know, in other words, if we reach a point where retailers aren't ordering new batches of Steel Diver. Ever.
Clearly not.
Yeah, it's never
so
happened.
At some point, retail runs out of copies. Like, they're all on the used market. There are no new copies of Steel Diver left anymore. At that point, Nintendo's got nothing to lose by throwing it up on the eShop. And I wonder if they're intentionally trying to wait for that point. If they're telling retailers, don't worry, we're not gonna, cause like, we know you want to get rid of your stock. And so we're gonna give you a chance to do that before we put it on the eShop and make it super convenient for people.
Yeah, I mean, it's all part of this tightrope that they're walking, where they are trying to be conciliatory with retailers about it. And I guess we still haven't seen how that's all going to play out. But it kind of strikes me as a little odd that we're as close as we are to New Super Mario Bros. 2 coming out in Europe and America. And I still haven't really heard that much about what retailers are going to be kind of participating in some of these things and what the price is going to be like relative to the eShop. It's surprising we're this close and there's still so much we don't know.
Yeah, now over here, like at GameStop, I'm just looking at it right now, they're adding an online-only exclusive gold Mario pin if you buy New Super Mario Bros. 2 at the full price of $39.99. So, yeah, they're not competing on price, that's for sure.
Yeah, but I bet Amazon will. I bet you Amazon sells this for $37.
Well, this is the card. I don't think this is a download code.
This is the actual cartridge, yeah. This is the...
Oh, okay, yeah. No, I think Amazon is going to sell a download code for Mario as well, and I'm very curious to see what they price that at, because then they're also sort of, they're competing with their own stock, because they're selling both versions, but one will be cheaper than the other. It's a fascinating time. It is. I'm really curious to see how it all plays out.
I'm curious more what they end up doing with these codes, like how widespread the sale of the codes are. Like, is it going to be a lot of people selling them, or is it just going to be a handful of retailers like it is right now with the eShop codes?
It's going to be really, really interesting. So the final email this week comes from Lalmaned, and he writes, "With the recent emergence of the Steam Summer Sale, I've wondered about your thoughts regarding the Steam Sales model being utilized in next-gen consoles, Wii U, PS4, Xbox, whatever. I believe Steam has tapped into a very clever business model with these daily deal formatted sales, and including this year's flash sales, where various games go on additional discount for 8 hours or less, brings an incentive for users to return to the store page. Oh boy, does it. I have several times found myself buying a game I passed over at first glance when checking for the newest flash sales. While Nintendo's recent temporary discounts on the eShop are a welcome start, I'm sure they're still very concerned about devaluing software. I've always believed price depreciation should exist on software, and that even if you don't necessarily believe that, a temporary price drop on a 2-plus-year-old game could provide much more revenue by tapping into a segment of gamers who maybe wouldn't have purchased the item at full price. I have two questions. Number one, what are everyone's thoughts regarding game devaluation? And two, how reasonable is it to hope for Nintendo or any of the major platform holders to utilize this style of sales promotions in next-gen consoles? As always, it's been a pleasure listening to your podcast while wishing I was anywhere but at work."
So can I answer part two again? Because yeah. I know the answer again. The 360 already does this. They actually have an app that they were pushing at one point that's just called like Daily Deals or something like that. And it's just a handful of – it's like bonus content, a download game, a full retail game, and usually like some stupid kit of Xbox avatar wear.
Oh, yeah.
Like you can get the Skyrim helmet for 20 Microsoft funny points off.
Hey, man, shut up. Skyrim helmet is awesome.
Why is your character not sporting it, John?
I've moved on from it, all right?
He's still wearing the Oblivion helmet.
Mine's dressed like a fucking fairy. The least you could do is put on a helmet.
John's avatar wears horse armor.
If
$5.
But so yeah, to an extent, Microsoft already does this. Now, they don't do the absolute sales tsunami that...
Yeah, it sounds like they do it. They just don't do it well.
Yeah, exactly.
There is obviously a tension between, on the one hand, if you have say, these kinds of sales, you know, so these eye-catching kind of discounts, it's a driver for traffic to that shop, and therefore what is mentioned in the letter by Lomanage, you know, the sort of incidental purchases that happen.
Oh, yes.
Is kind right. of what you're really looking for there. So because people get in the habit of kind of frequenting the store and all this kind of stuff, they end up buying things that they wouldn't have otherwise bought that wouldn't even necessarily be discounted at all. But the flip side of that, the bad part of it, which Nintendo have obviously spoken to directly, is that if you get a dependable culture of sales that drives people to go to the store all the time, it gets built into people's expectations. And they say, well, you know, I don't need this now. I could just wait until it inevitably goes on sale and pick it up cheaper.
It's like on Steam, everybody waits for the Steam Christmas sale.
So you, on the one hand, you might be sort of boosting revenue for yourself. And then on the other hand, you might be depriving yourself of what that would have been yours.
And that's why Steam is putting so many publishers out of business, except it's not. Because this is, I understand this fear that Nintendo has. It seems like a rational fear. But I think the real world has shown that this is not how things actually happen. What actually happens is everything on Steam is on sale all the time. Virtually anything that's been on there for more than a month is 10% off. Okay. So during the Steam sale, it's 75% off and a bunch of people buy it. And the company who publishes that game makes very, very little money on those sales. Okay. But again, a lot of these are people who never would have bought it at the normal price. Okay.
That's exactly it.
But then all those people go play it and talk about it and tell their friends about it. And because Steam is a social platform, all their friends see that they're playing it and then they ask them about it and they talk about it. And then everybody else goes and says, I might want to buy this game for myself. And when they go look at it, it's not $60 on Steam. It's 25% off or 50% off or whatever it is. And so the company making it is still not going to make whatever the original price is. Okay. But the game's already been out for a year. They couldn't hope to get that money for it. But what they will get is a lot more money than they would have if it was purchased during the sale.
Yeah.
This is standard retail economics. That's why you go into a retail furniture store, there's always a sale. The sale is different every month, but there's 12 months of sales at a furniture store. And I used to work in a furniture store, and I asked my boss once, I was like, why does it seem like there's always a sale? He's like, because you can't sell anything at retail price.
Mm-hmm. No, it's like jewelry. Jewelry's always on sale. That's because jewelry has like a 500% markup.
Yeah. But the amount of sale that it's on changes over time, and they rotate these things to match with customers' buying patterns. And games are especially great about that because nobody's buying jewelry on word of mouth. But people buy tons of video games based on word of mouth.
Sure.
So if you manage this properly, you can make a lot of money selling things at less than full price, which everybody else in America and the world figured out a long time ago. Video games are finally getting there.
Well, and also, you could call it price depreciation or as Lomino does, but the other way of looking at it is that what you're doing is price discrimination. You have one price initially, but actually everyone is willing to pay a different amount for it. And so you're kind of getting the people at the top first and just working your way down gradually over time until you're pretty much scraping the bottom of the barrel by the sound of some of these discounts. You know, the people are willing to pay only like $3, but you kind of getting there eventually, which of course is the sort of thing you can do digitally that would be far, far more of a problem with conventional retail and inventory and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it does make sense getting all the sales that you possibly can, working your way down. The problem, as I said, is what Nintendo sees is that how much does it get built into people's expectations? And I mean, from the outside, it's hard to say. You know, I'm sure there's studies done on how this kind of affects behavior and all that kind of stuff. But I think getting that traffic is a really big deal. I mean, I think there is really big upside to that, kind of what Lord Monet's talking about here, because if you look at the bad side of it is the Wii Shop channel. Yeah, the fact that did not drive people to keep coming back to it at all. And you got to a point where it may as well have not existed. Yeah, because of poor promotion, drip feed releases, all this kind of stuff, you know, that was not like a scene that anyone was frequenting.
Right.
And so when you had quality games
like Fluidity, I couldn't convince people to go get Fluidity, even though I told them it was one of my favorite games of the year, because it's on the Wii Shop channel and they own a Wii and they have access to it. They might even have points sitting in their wallet on the Wii Shop channel, but they hate going there so much and it's so outside of their normal gaming habits that they can't be bothered to go download an amazing game.
It's off the beaten tracks, metaphorically speaking. And that's the real issue. I think that sales of this sort can definitely help prevent that saying. There's a lot of other factors that go into it. I mean, you want the store to have a good interface, all that kind of stuff, so people don't feel like it's an unpleasant experience when they do go there. That's obviously going to help them coming back. And, as we said plenty of times, they're making progress on that with the eShop.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're moving in this direction. And I think the other thing you've got to look at is Miiverse. You want to talk the social aspect, people seeing what they're playing and all that. And clearly, Nintendo sees this as a crucial element of marketing. And I think very much a sense of regret that
you know, their hope that people would buy Wii Sports Resort or whatever, and it would ultimately lead them to buy more games, was completely stymied by the fact that people's Wiis were not connected and people weren't aware that there was this other stuff. And it's almost trying to right a big wrong, I think, the Miiverse, that, well, if only they could have seen that other people was playing this stuff, maybe they would go out and buy, like, Mario Super Sluggers or God knows what, you know.
Well, time will tell if they really learn these lessons. And I think Miiverse is potentially a really good tool for that. But I mean, there were a lot of tools built into even to Wii that they thought you could send messages, you know, because you can send messages over Wii Connect 24 to your friends after entering a 16-digit friend code for system to system that is used for nothing else, that you that people would recommend games to each other that way. And then they launched the Nintendo channel and they said, this will be great. We'll get people to go in and upload recommendations for all the games they own. And then other people will go in there and find it. So nobody used the Nintendo channel for that.
No, not for that.
The big part of it is getting it all integrated. You know, what I talked before about, oh, well, with eShop, we're integrating promotion and sales. And then with Wii U, you've got to integrate both of those things with the Miiverse and the social aspect. Right. If you take down all those barriers and all that kind of stuff, these things could work. And obviously the financial incentive of sales is going to be a big hook as well. And it's interesting looking at what they've done so far with the eShop stuff in the different territories. It's been a slightly different approach because with Japan, Europe, lapdog style following behind in exactly the same way, they did 2 weeks with each one having a different lineup of the most popular games on the eShop that had a discount applied to it. And so it was very brief, really. Whereas they've dragged it out a bit more in America, haven't they, with these deals of the weekend?
Yeah.
Although I understand that the most recent one is going to be the last, or at least for the time being. That was on Nintendo's Twitter feed.
Right. I saw that. And I suspect what that is they pre-planned this out, and so they had scheduled out a certain number of games. They'd made the agreements with the publishers and developers and et cetera to do all this, and then they – because they had to do it all in advance, they sort of did a slug of games and they said, let's do this, see how it works, take a step back, analyze our sales data and figure out, you know, how we want to adjust it for the next time. And I think eventually they might get to the point where they do these things continuously. But it makes sense to me that they might do a sort of a cluster of them at first in order to get that experience of how do you do this? How do you promote it?
Sure.
What kind of percentages in sales boost can we expect? And then that helps them manage it properly going forward. Like, were the discounts too big? Were they too small? You know, like it gives them some data that they can go back to. But I wouldn't be too concerned about the fact that those sales are ending right now. I think it's very temporary hiatus.
No, but I think Nintendo of America's approach just on this small, you know, sample, these little pilot schemes, if you like, that have been run, I think that's, to me, that intuitively seems like it's going to be more fruitful to have people coming back, you know, a smaller number, rather discounting a bunch of games at once necessarily with relatively small discounts. Having something to come back to like clockwork each and every week, I think that has a lot of value. So I think they're moving in the right direction, but I still feel like their natural conservatism will mean that you would not see deep, deep discounts on the order of Steam for a very long time at least, if not.
I agree. But look, psychology is the study of how to control behavior, and economics is the study of how to control behavior. So,
wow, you're getting deep here, Mr. Jung. What are you doing?
No, I'm saying that the idea of them training their customers to develop certain habits is completely legitimate, and it's what they should be doing as a business. That is what they're supposed to do. And they've trained us to buy every Zelda game that comes out. They did it by making good games.
The difference is economic theory at its most basic level assumes that we're all like brilliant, calculating, rational masterminds. And therefore that if when we see the existence of sales, we will do this like instant backward induction calculation and think, yep, right, I can sit on my hands, never buy anything full price again. But the real market psychology is a lot more organic than that.
Yes.
And that's the thing. I think Nintendo are afraid of that very like mechanical kind of effect. And of course, that does have an influence. It does exist, but it's actually bound up in a lot more stuff, and there's a lot of noise in between it.
Exactly. I mean, there's some games that people just have to buy right off the bat.
It is more, you know, it's the classic line of it's more of an art than a science. blending these different kinds of discounts and sales and seasonal and weekly and all. It is going to be a gradual process of seeing what works and doing more of what works and a gradual evolution. And that's why I think, you know, starting from a conservative position, it'll be a long time before we get those big discounts.
By the way, that furniture store I mentioned earlier where I used to work has been open for over 100 years on perpetual sales.
Yeah.
I think they might have I think it almost give Nintendo a run for their money on longevity.
That reminds me of the furniture store in London that survived the Blitz but not the riots last year. That's depressing.
Wow.
That is depressing.
So by the way, I mean, one thing we focused on Steam because that was the context of the email, but if you look at Nintendo's argument against this kind of thing and their concerns about trying to maintain the value, really what they mean is maintain the price. The value is a different concept, but trying to maintain the price of their games, they're mostly concerned about what's happened on the mobile platform on iPhone and Android. And I would say the difference there is, you know, on Steam, you're still working with a platform holder to set prices. So if you want to put your game on the Steam Summer Sale, that's a negotiation between the publisher and with Valve. And so they come up with a price that they think is sustainable and that will be effective for them. And if you don't want to be on the sale, you don't have to be, but also means that publishers can't undercut each other by pricing their games at $1, 50 cents, 25 cents, 2 cents.
Right. Valve's acting as a gatekeeper.
Yeah. And on the iPhone and on the Android marketplace, publishers basically price their games whatever the fuck they want. And that's been part of the problem. Nintendo will never allow that to happen. But what Steam does is somewhere in between. And I think that's a compromise that can be very effective. And it's a balance. You have to make sure you don't go too far one way or the other. And so I think that's what concerns Nintendo, because clearly it requires a certain expertise and an understanding of a market that they don't have much experience with. But they're getting that experience and they're going to refine their approach until they find something that's closer to what Steam has.
For Valve, though, it's actually a little bit easier because they themselves, I mean, they do produce games at a glacial pace, but the games they're selling aren't really direct competition with their products. For Nintendo, though, these people are much more their competition. And I think partially that's reality. Nintendo does need to consider that when they're discussing these price negotiations, but it's also a bit psychological. That's something they probably need to get out of their own heads. That they have to view all these partnerships as partnerships, and partnerships can be competitive, but they need to realize that there's money to be made for all parties involved. And maybe it's saying you can put your game on sale, but our cut percentage isn't going down. And it may even say our cut's not going down. It may be a hard dollar value they hold to, but you could do whatever you want beyond that. It's like you could charge exactly our cut if you want. Fine. Knock yourself out.
Yeah,
but that's as far down as it's going.
That's the thing, Nintendo. It's so ingrained in them to just be used to calling the shots all the time.
Right.
Well, and to an extent, to be ruthless. I mean, they're not the happy, fun, smiley company. There's an edge to that company that if you're.
I think taking WiiWare games from small indie publishers and choosing the price based on what you think it's worth on the market and ignoring any input or not even collecting input from the publisher. And overpricing the game to the point where no one actually wants to buy it because it's from a company no one's ever heard of and a brand new franchise and it's a kind of game that no one even understands because you don't have demos. That's not being ruthless. That's being stupid.
Mm-hmm. Possibly arrogant.
And that's the lesson that I hope they've learned.
Yeah, I don't know. Nintendo, arrogant?
I think they're actually evolving at a very rapid pace. I mean, you look at Iwata's speech about game prices and you know, sort of anti-iOS app store tirade. That was at GDC 2011, so about February or March of last year.
Yeah.
And not much more than a year later, Nintendo's announcing they're going to start sales on their digital products on the eShop, which didn't exist when he made that speech last year. So they've come a long way and they've learned a lot in a very short period of time. And partly they've been motivated by necessity, because when he made that speech, they weren't having the financial problems that they are now.
Well, they might have been. They might not have realized it
well,
yet.
They hadn't announced the financial problems.
yes.
That was a couple months before the fiscal report came out in April, I think.
Before the bombs got dropped.
Well, and I suppose it becomes, if you are in the position, if they think they're in the position that, well, we're going to have to concentrate a lot more on actually squeezing all the money we can out of the people that are actually in this space rather than, you know, expanding it, because it's going to be really difficult to do that mm-hmm. with all the kind of headwinds. There are then, again, as I said, that kind of price discrimination mechanism I talked about comes into play, because that is very much like, you just, let's just squeeze every dollar that there is to get.
Right.
Rather than worrying about when new people come in or whatever. And then that could be a fundamental change, that they are going to be a sort of much more kind of inward looking company now, and digital is going to be a big mechanism for them to get that money out of people's hands.
Okay, well, thanks everybody for the excellent emails, and as always, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We would love to hear from you. You can also head over to the show notes at the website and send us an email through that as well. And while you're at the website, you can go to the forums for our official forum thread on Wario Land 4, which will be the next retroactive game. Obviously, we're not going to talk about it on episode 300, probably be 301. So you've still got plenty of time. If you're an ambassador on 3DS, you've already got a copy. And if not, the game is fairly easy to acquire. It's a GBA game, and it's really good. So I hope you will participate and play along with us. Leave your thoughts in that forum thread. Again, there'll be a link in the show notes, and we will be talking about it fairly soon. I'm probably going to have to borrow a copy. That's okay. It's a stopgap measure. Also, we would love for you to go and rate and review us on iTunes. It's a big help in helping people discover the podcast, and that leads to more great emails and interactions and more votes for Retroactive. So it's good for you, too. And we would really appreciate that. You can like us on Facebook, and if you do so, you will get little updates about once a week on what's happening and when the new episodes are posted. And you can follow some of us on Twitter. I'm at Johnny Metz with no H and no Z. John?
Mr. Diamond J.
And James?
It's NWR James.
NWR James. And Greg is...
with an underscore.
Greg is a multi-headed hydra on Twitter. Have fun with that one if you try to find him. That's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. Thank you so much to Greg for joining us and filling in for Guillaume and for editing, especially.
I'm so sorry, Greg.
Fun power cuts, everything.
This is going to be a 20-minute long episode.
Mike's getting pulled out. It's been
yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I expect you to be like a constant backup, James, like running a little hamster wheel that powers your computer just in case the worst should happen. I'm doing that right now. Can't you tell I'm out of breath?
Well, because it's a laptop, it's fine. I just save, and I just lose my internet connection.
So be sure to look forward to next week when we have RFN 300, our 6-year anniversary of doing this here podcast. We weren't here in the beginning, but we might have some of the people who were. We will have special guests, and we're going to have a big feature discussion on Wii. Look forward to that. If anyone remembers our 200th episode, I think you can look forward to something of similar scope and grandeur. So it'll be fun, and we'll have Guillaume back as well, of course, along with a few other people. So please look forward to that, and we'll talk to you next week.